Welcome to The Book Show with me, Sinead Gleeson. We're on Facebook and Twitter at BookshowRTE, and this week on the show, we talk to Patrick DeWitt about writer Jane Bowles and how she has inspired him.
Tennessee Williams said that she was the most important writer of prose fiction in modern American letters.
But first up this evening, all over the country, people are members of book clubs, and Ireland now even has its own book club festival in Ennis, happening every year where people come to talk about books. But what is the appeal?
I think one of the really precious things about a book club is that it gives you permission to read, but also gives you an incentive to read. There's the sort of embarrassment element that you want to make sure to have read the book, before the next book club comes along.
Margaret Kelleher joined her book club over 20 years ago.
But I think also part of the pleasure of a book club is the diversity of reading that it gives you. I mean, one of the many pleasures of a book club is that you read books you'd never read otherwise.
John McGonigal has run his own Cork-based Index book club for the past 20 years.
The good thing about the book club, I suppose, is that you have your own type of style that you like reading, but when you're in a book club, the other people actually nominate different types of books. So there's one guy who kind of reads mainly crime, so then I actually got into crime, and then of course with a lot of the Scandinavian crime coming on board, it's really popular at the moment. So other people then had particular interests, other people selected books that were intellectual maybe, and other books were very light. So we had a good mix and we had great crack.
Many people pigeonhole book clubs for being women-only spaces, but not John's.
In our book club, we kind of, in the beginning, made it six guys and six girls. We also meet in pubs, but we don't meet in people's houses because I think there's a lot of competition then about what you're going to serve or what you're going to drink. Whereas we meet in pubs. In the beginning when we met, we would meet at 8 o'clock and we would be thrown out of the pub. And we'd be stay there till the very end. Now, since we've all got a little bit older, we arrive at about 8 o'clock and we leave at about maybe 9:30 at the latest, really. If you want to stay back, you might stay back with one or two people, but it's become very business-like over 20 years, so it's very focused on the books, whereas at the beginning it was much more a social thing with us.
But the social part, I think, is really important because, especially as the book club goes on over time, there's a way in which you're also reading your own lives through the book club. I mean, when I think of my book club, I've been a member since 1992, which means that many members of the book club have had children during that time. Many of us in recent years have been dealing with the bereavement of parents or the illness of parents. And there's a way in which, now that I think about it, that probably has inflected and shaped the kind of choices, you know, the books we read, be it in recent years. We've probably read quite a lot of autobiography, for example. And there's a way in which, I think, as you get to a certain time of your life, you're reading books that match where you are in your life.
After every book that we read, we vote on the book out of 10. And we're very competitive. So therefore, at the end of the year, we find out who's got the best book, who scored highest. We have a Christmas party where we dress up as characters from the books.
But what to do when members aren't pulling their weight?
So we have a president of the book club, and he is very, very strict. And his name is Paul. And recently we all got a letter. It was called Paul's Letter to the Sinners of the Book Club. So he would tell us what we can do, what we can't do, and how many meetings you attended, how many you didn't. If it goes under 8, you're in trouble. So it's good crack. We don't take it too seriously, even though that sounds very serious.
Margaret has a favourite book that they've read in her club.
The book that comes to mind straight away would be David Levitt's The Indian Clerk. And it's not just about the book, it's a very good book. It's a historical novel set at the turn of the century, kind of in the early decades of the 19th century, about an Indian self-taught man, a man called Ramanujan, who was a self-taught mathematical prodigy, who comes to England in 1913 to work with Hardy, who was an established mathematician in Cambridge. But I think for many book clubbers, where you read the book is often very important. Obviously, lots of book clubbers read it in each other's houses. But my book club occasionally goes abroad. And in this case, I had the great good fortune of spending 3 months in Cambridge. And my book club came to join me en masse. I describe them as the cavalry coming to the rescue because I think I was kind of lonely, really. And we read the book club in Cambridge. I managed to hire a room in St. John's College, Cambridge. And we got to read it in the freezing cold corridors that unfortunately led poor Ramanujan to be quite ill during his time in Cambridge, but allowed us to read the book in the atmosphere. So for me, where I read the book and who I read it with is part of the memory, really.
In Cavan Library, County Librarian Josephine Brady wanted to do something more with the book club.
It's very much part of the role of public librarians, not just that we love the world of literature and want to bring that to our communities, but we really feel that we have a role to play in improving our communities and changing our communities for the better.
She's come up with the type of book club that gets a lot of people reading books. In fact, 100 books with a difference, all with an equality theme that explored difference and discrimination.
We test ran them with our own reading groups, and we have 3 reading groups in Cavan.
10 categories of books on equality have been selected.
We're really ambitious. We want a global conversation around books that are interesting, important, relevant under equality grounds.
They offer readers books grouped and covering areas such as age, disability and sexual orientation.
I think book clubs struggle to find great reads, and there can be this desire to constantly go with the next big thing and forget that we have this wealth of literature at our fingertips. And that's where the public librarian comes in. That's where our knowledge and skills come in, but also our relationship with readers comes in, because we're always finding hidden gems that we want to share. And this was an approach that had never been used before.
In the age category alone, novels like Ending Up by Kingsley Amis and The Sea by John Banville feature.
So we wanted to make sure that under every ground there was at least 4, if not 6 novels. And that was difficult in certain grounds, like for instance the traveller community ground, because their culture is a very rich oral culture. And it's very, very hard to find really good novels dealing with the traveller community and difference. But we were determined and we succeeded in getting at least 4, if not 6 novels under each of the grounds. We have 51 novels in there.
Books, say Josephine, are a powerful force.
Certainly if you read even one of the 100 books, it will change you significantly. And if you share it with a reading group and share it with other readers, there's a reason why books are burned. And not just in Nazi times, there is a reason, because the power of books that can change everything if they're put into the right hand at the right time.
If you want to find out more about 100 Books with a Difference and how to get started reading through the list, go to 100booksswithadifference.blogspot.ie. For some, though, joining a book club can be made even easier if you add a twist. Zoe Cummins went along to the Lighthouse Cinema in Smithfield in Dublin, where the monthly cinema book club takes place. As Zoe arrives, this month's chosen film, Francis Ford Coppola's take on Bram Stoker's Dracula, is finishing with Annie Lennox's unmistakable song playing as the credits roll. Come into these arms again,
set this spirit free. There's at least 25 people milling around the foyer of the Lighthouse Cinema, waiting for the book club to start.
I'm Charlene. I am the programmer here in the Lighthouse. I choose the films, basically. So rather than always sort of going, oh, the book's better than the film, or the film's better than the book, I really like the idea of sitting down and actually beefing it out and going, well, why do you think the film is better than the book, or why is the book better than the film?
There's a real buzz about the film, and this month, Dr. Harvey O'Brien has come along to chat about Dracula. He lectures in horror in UCD.
I think Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula is a really good talking point when we think about adaptations and novels, precisely because it identifies itself by that label, Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. When you start to think about labeling and authoring and interpretation, you're being presented here explicitly by the filmmaker with a statement that, well, this is based on the original. Whereas actually it's Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. So in looking at the film, you're forced to consider the difference in authorial voice between the novel and the film.
Count Dracula?
I am Dracula. And I bid you welcome, Mr. Harker, to my house.
You know, Dracula is such a part of our cultural memory now.
Yeah.
That you pick up the book and you know to some extent what's happening, but I was just imagining how great would it be to come to this with a fresh eye and just read Jonathan's account.
I like the film, and I can see the issues with it as an adaptation, that it's not true to the original source material. But, you know, that's what an adaptation does. You know, it changes something, brings something maybe fresh to it.
If Bram Stoker's Dracula, never does Dracula write anything or speak or have a voice?
So this guy's just given him, just given an interpretation of what Dracula's voice might be and who he might actually be, because in the book he's just he's a shadow.
The most beautiful place in all creation.
A land beyond a great vast forest, surrounded by majestic mountains, lush vineyards.
What I found interesting about Winona Ryder is that from reading the book, if you told me Winona Ryder is going to play the character, I would have said, fine, she's kind of fragile, but some inner strength and so on. But then when she's in the film and she's trying to come across as kind of gamey and so on with Dracula, it's kind of, I am not convinced by that at all with Winona Ryder.
I think in the book, she's a paragon of femininity to the point of gross exaggeration, that everyone has her up on a pedestal. She's the ultimate woman at all times. They're all worshipping at the altar of Mina. And I think, personally, again, bringing it back to the literary origins, I think that's Bram Stoker working out his own frustrations around his wife. Again, we know this from family records and stuff. Florence Stoker was not the most warm of individuals, and he was a very isolated figure in that marriage. And so I think his presentation of femininity was exaggerated and was driven by sexual frustration and fantasy.
Everyone gets to have their say at the book club.
Lugging around these boxes of earth like he's died, he says. And he's pretty much vanquished by a typewriter. So
when he turns up in Piccadilly, couldn't they just kill him then? Like, why did it have to go off another like 100 pages?
I think that Coppola really did this. He made a gorgeous film.
So, I mean, again, it's what does it symbolise? You know, what do you feel disturbed by? I mean, whatever about horror is being scary, I think they should always disturb you. They should always disturb your equilibrium and make you kind of go, ooh, and move your brain into a twilight zone where you're considering alternatives and possibilities and ways of seeing the world.
Chelsea Morgan Hoffman also runs the film book club.
I quite like watching the film first and then reading the novel afterwards, because I feel like if I love the film, I'm always going to get more from the novel. This club, I hope, at least to me, acts in some sort of way to kind of get people to explore books that they wouldn't normally come across. I don't think I would have read Dangerous Liaisons had I not been doing book club. I don't know that I would read Jurassic Park ever, really, if we weren't going to be doing it in book club, but it kind of opens up these new worlds to me.
We just really like the idea of engaging with people and getting people to sit around and talk about film, because it's rare to get that opportunity, really.
Thanks there to Zoe Cummins and to the monthly Lighthouse Cinema Book Club. If you're interested in going along, they'll be discussing The Shawshank Redemption by Stephen King this Monday, April 28th. The screening of the film itself starts at 6:30 p.m. and there are more details at lighthousecinema.ie. Now, there are plenty of book clubs around the country, including many with the local libraries. So if you can't find one to join, perhaps you could start one yourself. Just gather a bunch of people, pick a book. It's as simple as that, really. In fact, one of the biggest and best-selling book club books of the past decade was Karen Joy Fowler's The Jane Austen Book Club, made into a very successful film in 2007 and still stands out as a huge celebration of reading. I met with Fowler recently and asked her, how did she come up with the idea for the book?
I've only got two novels that I can tell you exactly the moment I knew I would write the book, and the Jane Austen Book Club is one of those. I had gone to hear my friend Carter Schultz do a reading at a Book Passage bookstore in Corte Madero, California, and there was a sign on the wall, which I read as I was waiting for Carter to start, which said the Jane Austen Book Club. And because I was in a bookstore, there was just this moment where I thought that was the title of a book, that I could go and buy that book. And I sort of felt my heart leap. I thought, I have loved Austen all my life. I will love that book. And my second thought was, what a great idea. I wish I had had it. And then my third thought, looking more closely at the sign, which had dates and times and locations, was that it actually was not the title of a book. It was, in fact, a book club of people who were going to be reading Jane Austen's novels. And I knew instantly that I would write that book, since nobody else had done so, and since it was clearly a great idea. To jump ahead to the end of the story, I wrote the book, I published the book, and I was asked to speak at the General Assembly of the Jane Austen Society of North America, and a woman in the audience raised her hand and said, I just want you to know I'm the person who put that sign in that bookstore. I asked her to meet me afterwards. I said, you know, please let me buy you a drink. But in my heart, I was thinking, really, I owe you a car.
Were you tempted when you saw that sign to try and, you know, work your way into that book club or join a book club or go and hang out at a book club for research purposes? Or had you been in a book club before?
Yes, I actually ran a book club at the local bookstore in Davis where I was. So I knew all about how women behave in book clubs. And I loved the book club that I ran in Davis, but that was a cranky group of women. I would always pick a book, and it would always be a book I absolutely loved. And then I would spend the whole evening hearing the shortcomings that they saw in the book and how the ending did not really satisfy them or the beginning did not really satisfy them. And every once in a while we would do one of my books and then they would, you know, grow very polite and we would sit in a circle and they would say, well, I really liked Karen's book, didn't you? Yes, I really liked Karen's book. And I would think, I'm not even going to go to the bathroom here because I know what you'll be saying the minute I'm out of the room.
Why Jane Austen is in the Jane Austen book club? Why not, you know, the Bronte book club, the Philip Roth book club? Why Jane Austen? Why her?
I don't think we have the weather in Northern California for the Bronte book club. I just can't see that. Although personally, I love the Brontes pretty much as much as I love Jane Austen, but for very different reasons. I was interested in the passion people feel towards her books. There are a handful of writers, and I really do think it's only a handful, who create a group of people who love their books so much that it's not sufficient just to stay at home and read them and appreciate them. You have to get together on weekends with people who also love them, and you have to dress as if you're a character in the book and learn the dances and learn the music. Another community I'm very fond of is science fiction, which accomplishes the same thing, that, again, it's not enough to read the books. You have to pretend that you live in them. And I was interested in, what about those books? What makes a book so compelling that it creates an entire world that people feel the need to live in?
What kind of feedback did you get from book clubs after the book came out?
Interestingly, I think when I wrote the book, I knew this was a more commercial idea than I usually had. I expected to sell better than I usually did. I did not expect to sell as much better as I usually did. I thought there are 2,000 people in the Jane Austen Society of North America. Maybe half of them will buy my book. That will be better than I usually do. So I thought the part of the title that would sell the book was the Jane Austen part. I thought, you put Jane Austen on a book and people want to read it. I think I hit a moment in the zeitgeist when the part of the title that actually sold the book was book club, that the book club phenomenon in North America, starting with the Oprah book club picks, had just become enormous. My beloved editor said to me at one point that the women's book clubs were the only thing keeping literature alive in America. And so I think the idea of reading a book about a book club and then discussing it in your own book club was very appealing to a lot of people. And the feedback was pretty good. And they were, generally, the book club women were less cranky than the Jane Austen women, as it turned out.
I was in a book club once, and the biggest fight we ever had about a book was Madame Bovary. There was practically murder.
Interesting.
But what do you think makes a good book club book?
Well, I think a good book club book is a book that people feel strongly about and that they have very diverse opinions of. I think a good book club book is one where, yes, it almost comes to blows. If everybody loves it, there's really not all that much to discuss. And if everybody hates it, there's a lot to discuss, but it's not entirely pleasurable. So the book club books that I think have been more successful have been the ones where there was a real divergence of opinion.
Thanks there to Karen Joy Fowler for chatting to us about the Jane Austen Book Club. If you're interested, Karen has a new novel out called We're All Completely Beside Ourselves and tells the story of a unique family and their very unusual child. It's published by Servant's Tale. You might want to pick that or another book for your book club. We'd love to hear your suggestions as to what makes a great book club read. You can tweet us at bookshowrte. Now, moving on, Patrick DeWitt is a Canadian writer who was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize in 2011 for his second novel, The Sisters Brothers, which tells the story of two assassin cowboys. We asked Patrick DeWitt to tell the book show about a book that has really had an impact on him, and he chose a novel by Jane Bowles.
Jane Bowles was born in 1917 in New York City, and she died in 1973. And she wrote only one novel. It was called Two Serious Ladies, and she had a very difficult life. It was beset with illness and alcoholism.
The world and the people in it had suddenly slipped beyond her comprehension.
She's a writer's writer rather than someone who's read by somebody who just wants to sort of relax at the beach.
She felt in great danger of losing the whole world once and for all. A feeling that is difficult to explain.
John Ashbery loved her work, and Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams said that she was the most important writer of prose fiction in modern American letters.
On some days, the need to write lodges itself in my throat like a cry that needs to be uttered.
The story in Two Serious Ladies is something of a non-story, actually. It's not a plot-based book. It's about two women, the two serious ladies. One is named Miss Goring, Christina Goring.
"Oh, Christina Goring," cried Mrs. Copperfield, startled to see her friend suddenly seated beside her.
And then there's Mrs. Copperfield, and they meet at the beginning of the book and have a sort of unremarkable back and forth.
"I'm going away. Do you mean," said Mrs. Goring, "that you are leaving this party?"
And then they meet again at the end, and the rest of the book is made up of their individual adventures.
"No, I'm going on a trip. Wait till I tell you about it. It's terrible."
And I think for a certain type of reader, Two Serious Ladies is extremely frustrating. It's a very difficult book in that if you want something big to happen, it never really comes. And I think it subverts a lot of traditional expectations. With Christina Goring, she's this sort of intensely malleable person. People just show up in her life and ask to stay for no reason of note, and she allows them to stay, to live with her even. There's a Mrs. Gamelon who shows up and lives with her. And her being there is puzzling because she's very antagonistic towards Christina Goring. And yet Christina Goring never kicks her out or takes control of her own life in some way. A man named Arnold shows up and decides to also stay with them. Arnold's father is hot on his heels. And these people just sort of show up and revolve around Christina Goring. And she allows it, but isn't particularly interested in their lives.
"Since you live so far out of town," said Arnold, "why don't you spend the night at my house? We have an extra bedroom." "I probably shall," said Miss Goring, "although it is against my entire code. But then, I have never even begun to use my code, although I judge everything by it."
And then we have Mrs. Copperfield, who goes to South America with her husband. She sort of instantly ditches him and takes up with an area prostitute that she essentially falls in love with and becomes perfectly obsessed by, named Pacifica.
Mrs. Copperfield felt happy and sick at once. She turned her face, and in so doing, she brushed Pacifica's heavy stomach with her cheek. She held on hard to Pacifica's thigh with the strength of years of sorrow and frustration in her hand.
These are stories of bisexual women or lesbian women, and though it's never discussed overtly, I think it was definitely pushing it for the time period. This is the 1940s, you know, people weren't necessarily writing about this sort of thing. Jane Bowles herself was a bisexual or maybe leaning more towards a lesbian. She seemed much more interested in women. Mrs. Copperfield brings Pacifica back to New York City, where at the end of the novel she bumps back into Christina Goring.
"I have gone to pieces, which is a thing I've wanted to do for years. I know I am as guilty as can be, but I have my happiness, which I guard like a wolf. And I have authority now, and a certain amount of daring, which, if you remember correctly, I never had before."
And then also I think that it was just ahead of its curve in terms of its style. It's just, you know, sort of like a modernist classic. You know, at the time it was really, there'd never been a book written like this before.
"She was suffering as much as she had ever suffered before, because she was going to do what she wanted to do. But it would not make her happy.
But Two Serious Ladies to me is completely singular, and I don't think there's another book like it, and so it should be read, if only for that reason, just to read a book that is truly unique.
She did not have the courage to stop from doing what she wanted to do. She knew that it would not make her happy, because only the dreams of crazy people come true.
And thanks to Patrick DeWitt for sharing his thoughts on Two Serious Ladies by Jane Bowles. The readings in that piece were by Emma McIver. Patrick's own book, The Sisters Brothers, is published by Granta. And Two Serious Ladies is available online. Or if you're lucky, you might pick up a copy in your local bookshop or secondhand. Finally this evening, Michael Simmons Roberts won the Costa Prize this year for his collection of sonnets, Dry Psalter. He recited Night Train for the book show.
Dry Psalter contains 150 poems of 15 lines each. A Night Train is, for me, a poem with a rare moment of genesis in that I was on a train and very rarely write in the experience that I'm having. But there was something strange about this very late night train, the passengers not speaking to each other, and yet an odd feeling of connectedness and community between us. Night Train. Lit not so she can see to clip our tickets, nor so we can read the news, but lit to make of us and it an eel-shaped full vivarium, to show the wild hills what a world can be. And I would like to say our thoughts as passengers crack between us like a static cloud, and soul means a million points of interconnection and bind, but none of this is true tonight. Instead, the slow fields, level crossings, tight grey farmsteads hear and miss us, passing like a single slub of thought from south to north, slowest synapse ever, one idea, say, life as journey, fading even as it bears us, and silence in its wake.
That was Michael Simmons Roberts and Night Train from his collection Dry Psalter, which is published by Jonathan Cape. That's all we've time for this evening. The book show was produced by Zoe Cummins, and we're back next week at 7 p.m. But we leave you this evening with the risque footnote by Regan Hutchins on Samuel Johnson.
Writing is torture. So it's just as well some authors have enjoyed a little slap and tickle over the centuries. Samuel Johnson, the great 18th century English critic, essayist and scribe of the famous dictionary, was one such literary masochist. His deep friendship with a Mrs. Hester Thrale involved this formidable woman on visits to his house whipping poor Johnson into a giddy and sore ecstasy. Many of those who suffered under his barbed pen and spiked tongue would have wished to inflict the same brutality on him as Mrs. Thrale did. Then again, perhaps they'd have changed their minds if they knew quite how much pleasure he derived from a good flogging.